Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest this time is Paul Weimer, and we are going to be discussing And Call Me Conrad by Roger Zelazny, which was the co-winner of the 1966 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So hi there, Paul. Thanks for joining me.
I'm pleased to be here, Seth. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast.
It's great to have you. And of course, this is, I always like to highlight, if I'm hosting a Hugo nominee, a three-time Hugo nominee, I believe, right?
Three times for fan writer. I'm previously two times for podcast with Skiffy and Fanti.
Right,
so,
right.
So if you actually count them, yes, I have five nominations, including this year.
I think the math works out on that. So why don't you tell my listeners about yourself?
Okay, well, I'm a Hugo finalist, past and present. We know that. My name is Paul Weimer. You can find me on the internet as Prince Justin, PrinceJVstin. If you Google that in any science fiction context, you will run into things I've done. I was well known as being a staple of the old SF Signal blog back in the day and the podcast back in the day. Since that closed some years ago, I've been putting book reviews, comments, and stuff everywhere from Twitter, Nerds of a Feather, which is a Hugo winner last year. Although I'm not a winner, I'm winner for that. I was just a writer, not an editor. Tor.com, Green Man Reviews. I mean, you throw a rock on science fiction internet and you can probably hit me somewhere along the line. Right. I kind of tend to be ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. Or you'll see your photos, right?
Or you'll see my photos. Yes, I am also an amateur photographer, mainly focusing on landscapes, architecture, and whatnot. It's mainly my travels and adventures and I taking photos while on them and sharing them incessantly with anybody who I can get eyeballs on them.
Well, I think there's some spectacular photos, so they're worth sharing.
Including of your home state of Oregon, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Which was last year's adventure.
I'd seen that on there and I was like, where does this guy live? Because like in your Twitter bio, I don't think you have a specific.
No, I list the Vale of Garnath Amber, which kind of flags a little bit of my literary interests right there for those who know.
Yeah, yeah. Which that ties in with what we're talking about today, right?
Exactly. We were talking about And Call Me Conrad or This Immortal by Roger Zelazny, as a matter of fact. As you said, the co-winner with the much more well-known Zune.
Right, yeah. Well, so how about a little bit of your history as a science fiction fan, your nerdy history?
Okay, so I started reading science fiction about age 9 to 10, thanks to my older brother, who was also a science fiction fan. He pushed Asimov and Bradbury into my hands, let me borrow stuff from him, and I kind of never looked back. It kind of like, okay, I mean, science fiction and fantasy is my default fiction reading. I don't read a lot of mimetic fiction. I just find it not speculative enough for my tastes. Mm. I mean, I even got in trouble in sixth grade because I was bored stiff in reading class, something you'd think I'd like, but because I didn't like anything they were reading. Like, I wanted to read science fiction and fantasy instead of the boring crap they were trying to push at me. So. Mm-hmm. So I've been reading for 40 years. So I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy and just gobble it up, both reading and also audiobooks. I mean, yes, I went to Oregon. What do you think I did driving west? I listened to audiobooks, right. Lots of history and nonfiction, but also science fiction and fantasy as well, because you got to eat up those miles somehow.
Definitely. Yeah. For me, I kind of go alternating between podcasts and audiobooks, depending on what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you happen to tally up your Hugo count?
I did. Now, humble brag, it's easier to count which ones I've missed.
Nice.
Because you see, back in the mid-90s, I decided to read award winners and nominees. So I started reading the short lists of the Nebulas and the Hugos every year and started reading the backlog of stuff I hadn't already caught. And honestly, there are three Hugo winners I've not read.
Okay.
The Wanderer, They'd Rather Be Right, which is out of print and hard to find, and A Case of Conscience. I need to get those too because, you know, they're glaring holes in my reading biography and I need to fix them at some point.
Yeah. I have episodes on two out of those three, but The Wanderer is one of the remaining. I think there's only three left that nobody's claimed yet.
Huh.
Yeah. So I'm sure I'll get it eventually. But I'm at 65 now, so I don't know how many that means I have left, like 11, maybe something like that. I don't know. I count the
So what's the biggest profile one you haven't read yet? as far as well known? I mean, The Wanderer is pretty obscure. I mean, the two I mentioned are very obscure as well.
Yeah, I mean, like the largest profile ones tended to go quickly, right? Because I just let my guest choose. And so I'm trying to think what would be considered that. Probably the Mars books. And those are ones I'm working through now.
Yeah, I mean, those are big, thick tomes. So, yeah. So people might be reluctant to tackle Kim Stanley Robinson because, you know, it is an investment of time and effort to get into the deep. It's worth it, mind you. I think they're brilliant, but they do take effort to get into.
I'll reserve my thoughts on that one for a future episode.
Yep.
Cool. So why did you choose And Call Me Conrad? And I feel like I've got a little bit of a hint from our discussion so far.
Because early in my science fiction reading, probably like 10 or 11, one of the early books that my brother impressed upon me was The Chronicles of Amber by one Roger Zelazny. So Roger Zelazny has been one of my several heart authors for all of my science fiction and reading life. So when you presented the list of possibilities, of course I was going to pick the Zelazny because it's Zelazny. So, and I wanted to revisit the book because I had not read it in 30 years or so. Mm. This was one of the last of the major Zelazny novels I actually wound up reading. So it was like by late 80s. So I wanted to revisit it and see how it held up and see what I could pick from it that earlier me didn't pick up from it. And, you know, spread the goodness of Roger Zelazny to your listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I had covered Lord of Light pretty early on. So this is a good spread between the two Zelazny.
Yeah, I think we were talking way back when that, yeah, you had done Lord of Light, but you're like, oh, no, you didn't do Call Me Conrad. Great. We'll do that one.
Now, am I correct in thinking that And Call Me Conrad is one of Zelazny's first novels?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's very early in his oeuvre.
Okay.
Might actually be his first full novel.
I think I did read that it was his first one, and it was serialized. Was it serialized as N. Conrad?
It was serialized, and there was some debate over the change from the serial to the full edition. There was some text lost that he had to fight to get into the reissued edition. So I bought the American Science Fiction Four Classic Novels 1960-1966 Gary K. Wolf.
Hugo Winner, that has editor. Waystation in it, and
yeah, it's got. High Crusade, Waystate, the Hugo winning Waystation, Flowers for Algernon, and Call Me Conrad. So I thought like this would be a good way to get those in a nice book format rather than reading as an ebook. So it was a magazine of fantasy and science fiction that serialized in Call Me Conrad. And according to the text, it is his first full novel. So
interesting.
I find that really interesting.
Just a kind of a random note here. I read it from Google Play Books. I was just looking for an ebook version of it, and that's where I could find it, where I could get it for pretty cheap. And it's kind of a bad OCR book. Ooh. Where like every time the word burn came up, it was rendered as bum.
So. Oh, that is unfortunate. I mean, normally I would have wanted, I probably would have gotten the ebook, but since I hadn't had this one in physical and I got three other awesome novels with it, it's like, okay, I'll pay the extra shekels or denarii for the physical book. And
I almost got that edition as well. If I hadn't covered Waystation already, I probably would have gotten it.
It's been a long time since I read Waystation too. So
yeah, I like that one a lot.
But that's a side note. I mean, I've read some Simak in recent years for SSF Audio, one of the podcasts I'm currently, I frequently on, we do lots of older stuff. And so we've done a couple of Simak novels, The Goblin Reservation, and a couple others. So
nice.
So, yeah. So that podcast in particular allows me, and now here for this episode, allows me to dive into rereads and older stuff that I've missed that I can like dive and do good digging in. I mean, there are some fan writers who do that, like say my fellow nominee Cor Bulert, is really good at the older science fiction and fantasy, and that's really her niche. I mean, I like the stuff, but I try to balance between that and trying to read the tsunami of new stuff and keep on top of the field and present myself as a authentic fan writer voice and genre that people can trust and you listen to. So it's kind of a balancing act, trying to read, kind of plug the holes and read and reread older stuff and try to keep up with everything that's new. And you can't, but I can do as best I can.
There really is a mountain. So
there is a mountain, but so Zelazny, since it's hard author, like, yep, let's do that one. That's
nice.
Definitely what I wanted.
So let's go ahead and kick off the official non-spoiler discussion of the book. And can you give us a little bit of a non-spoiler synopsis for this one?
The titular Conrad, although he has many names for reasons that come clear in the book, lives in a far future ruined earth. And he's acting as a tour guide to a Vegan who may or may not be set to basically buy the planet. In the process of doing this, we tour some of the area around the Mediterranean. We get some more and more sense of who Conrad is and what he is. And there's threats, there's danger, there's weird cultures, and Conrad has to make some decisions, and the people around him have to figure out what he wants and what should be done about this Vegan that wants to buy the Earth, and what is Earth's fate and future, and what does Conrad's true nature have to do with all that? So right. It's questions of identity, politics, self-determination, all sorts of mystery, myth, mythology, sociology, all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, this one definitely leaves you with a few questions that aren't definitively answered, where I feel like I could be thinking about it for years and not come to conclusions.
There's lots of nebulousness by design. And I have opinions and ideas, maybe we'll get later about that.
Yeah.
About what's going on in Conrad himself that isn't explicit, but maybe you can kind of hint if you stare at it.
Right, right. So like I mentioned, I'm working through the Mars series. And so this book that was short and interesting and engaging is exactly what I needed right now. Not to give away my thoughts about the Mars books, but...
No. The Mars books, by comparison, I mean, can be how... I'm going to try to be neutral about this. Can be... Ponderous sounds a little awful. That's not quite me. They can be kind of walls of words also sounds pejorative, but
right.
I mean, it's kind of like taking the slow train across the Martian landscape.
There we go.
The very slow train, or a wagon train across the West, and then just the scenery is going by at 1 mile an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
and
accurate.
While the scenery is all beautiful, sometimes you do want to get to the point, but you know, he's doing a thing, and a thing doesn't always translate, especially when time is limited, and sometimes you want your character to get caught by cannibalistic barbarians just for some action for a change.
Exactly.
Like in this book.
This is the Mad Max portion of the book.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I enjoyed this one. This one was fun and interesting, and I'll, like I said, there's things about it that, like, I feel like on a reread I would pick some other things up. So I wanted to ask you, like, your overall thoughts on the book. Sounds like you read it a long time ago and then you just reread it. Any differences in the way it hit you?
Yeah, it hit me so much as, yes, it's early Zelazny, and I can see ideas and things he wanted to do in later books kind of here in a prototypical form that he's still working out what kinds of things he liked, wanted to write about in longer form rather than short stories, and trying to basically kick the tires of the novel format and get it going. If you look at Conrad himself is an old character, older than people realize, and possibly older than, even he himself says, and you can see in Conrad a prototype, an archetype, a first draft is not the right word, a model for Prince Corwin in the Amber novels, Sam in Lord of Light, Jack in Jack of Shadows, a character who's mythic, has certain powers sometimes that he himself doesn't quite understand, or his companions clearly don't, or is not clearly rendered to the reader. Mythic histories and ideas swirling around him, strange and garish characters, colorful and often surreal adventures. There's lots of here that he's working out that he would later refine in his later books. So this is feels more like Zelazny 1.0, which I didn't quite get the first time. I was like, oh, that's a Zelazny book. Great. Now, having read all this stuff and reread some of his stuff since then, I can see where he's laying down tracks he's going to later build upon and grow upon later on down his career. So it's kind of weird that this is the novel he co-wins a Hugo for, as opposed to some of his more developed and refined work. I mean, this raw first novel is where he gets a Hugo for best novel, as opposed to, say, Nine Princes and Amber or Jack of Shadows or
right.
And of course Lord of Light. But it's like it feels almost like came too early in some sense. It's like, but he's not fully himself yet as a writer, and yet, I mean, just because of the vicissitudes of Hugo winners, he gets the gold prize here because of the power of his writing and the raw energy that and the punchiness of the thing that readers picked up. I mean, it's interesting that this one with Dune, which is a very different book on so many levels, and yet not. I mean, Dune is full of history and myth and precognition, which both these novels have in common. It's like, because Cassandra can see the future, and of course, Paul can. And so it's like, and the future of humanity. I mean, the Dune universe is completely without aliens, but this here, it's like, what is man, and where is man going, and wither Earth versus wither the Galactic Empire. So the novels kind of are of the same moment, even if they take very different tacks and very different styles.
Yeah. This book is, like I said, it's on the brief side, and yet I feel like it's a kind of rich, just the mood of the book is quite fascinating to me. And it's like, he is not real interested in dumping a bunch of exposition on you about the history of Earth. It's just like, I'm going to drop you into this, you know, after some horrible disasters for who knows how long, and give you a little tour of some of the ruins of the ancient sites that aliens are interested in looking at. And I really admire that he didn't spend another 200 pages describing everything.
No, he leaves it to your imagination. He sketches it in enough that you can know where it's going, but you don't need to. You need to know, see the world beyond the fuzzy background to the sharp focus that we have. I mean, this novel only really takes place around a few sites in Greece and Egypt. And that's it.
Right.
But we can imagine what the rest of the world is like. We get a sense of enough of it that we kind of know how it will go, but we don't need to know what's happening in, say, Japan. I mean, we can imagine it, but we don't need to go there.
Yeah, I was sort of imagining this book as taking place in a shared universe with Dream Snake, because of it kept talking about like hot spots where
Von de Magdar. Yes, yeah. I mean, this is a post-apocalyptic Earth. There are places you don't go, and there are mutants and things that come out of those hot spots.
Yeah,
some really, really terrifying things. And yeah, I could see how you could have Vonda McIntyre's characters wandering around somewhere else in North America, say,
right,
and completely cut off from what Conrad and company are doing.
Yeah, because there's definitely hints that there's technology, right? Because they have, they call them skimmers or some kind of fast transport, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, he doesn't focus a lot on the technology because that's just not his thing.
Right.
It's just a plot device to get from one place to the other pretty quickly. But on the other hand, he does like the analog, like Conrad's dog traveling across Greece to find him again.
Right. Right.
I just loved it. Like the loyalty of the hellhound. And it's called a hellhound. It's like, right. Now I see where he gave Prince Julian hellhounds in Amber. He was stealing them from his own book. Got it.
Are there any, like I mentioned that I kind of, my mental picture of this was kind of similar to when I was reading Dream Snake. I just sort of pictured the landscapes being similar. But for you, are there any comps to this book that you would throw out?
Dream Snake is a good one. I hadn't thought of that, but there are some authors who definitely resonate with this book that if people like this, they would like that. I mean, Gene Wolfe's The Dying Earth is a different kind of far future, but it's the same sort of things are broken. People are living in the ruins. There's aliens around. Hmm. You're not quite sure who is who or what is what. And you have a narrator who's somewhat unreliable, not immortal, like say a Conrad is, but Severian is definitely more than he himself even knows and appears. So I think people who like The Dying Earth will like this and vice versa. That also said, Adrian Tchaikovsky, particularly his Cage of Souls, which is another Dying Earth book, which is a little more urban, but it's like the last colony and the last prison on Earth, surrounded by endless jungle and changed people and changed world, feels. I just recently read a Cage of Souls, so that felt really resonant with this book as well. Charlie Jane Anders's work also depicting weird societies and the people inside of them, I think, also resonates. Joe Graham's work has a strong mythic resonance, and I think fans of her work will also like this and vice versa. Some early Linda Nagato also actually, I think, resonates with Zelazny in some ways and vice versa, especially stories like, say, the Martian Obelisk, for example, feels very much like in communication with books like this. And I could not remember the name of the book. It's the Silverberg book. I blanked on it.
Nightwings.
Thank you. I blanked on it. Yes, Nightwings. Because, you know, fallen, ruined Rome, still the center of the earth, as it were, and aliens on the edge, ready to come swooping in, is very much like, yeah, I can see how Silverberg read this and think, yeah, I can do that and just change things. I mean, you also get some weird technology. You get stratified in odd human societies, and yeah, so
yeah, that's a good one. I hadn't thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but the Bonda McIntyre's Dream Snake, that's a good one. Just trying to think of something else. That doesn't quite fit. No, I think that's a good set for readers who want to read further or come from those writers to hear.
Right. Anything else you want to cover in non-spoilers before we dive into spoiler talk?
No, I think we put up the spoiler wall at this point.
Okay. Sounds good. Let's do it. So yeah, anything you want to cover, any parts of the book you want to talk about, themes, whatever.
Yeah. So I'll do this in a Socratic way. How old do you think Conrad really is?
There were several times where my opinion changed on that. Cause I was like, he starts playing the pan pipes at some point, and I'm like, is he literally the great god Pan? and in which case he's effectively immortal and has been around a really, really long time. Or is he only, you know, a couple hundred years old? And I have no idea. And I feel like that's Zelazny did that on purpose.
He did that. I think he did do that on purpose. I mean, canonically, we know he's at least a couple hundred years old because he's had a prior life as basically a rebel. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't explicitly say anything about having lived before the bombs.
Right. The 3 days.
The 3 days. Yes. But on the other hand, I mean, he plays the pipe, and we can write off the he's playing the pipe stuff, and basically the mythic resonances throughout this book, because there are just so many mythic references. He's in mythic resonance with other stuff. I mean, this is not Creatures of Light and Darkness, where you have gods and whatnot who are much older. But on the other hand, Zelazny does like to play with those sorts of characters and ideas. I mean, Prince Corwin didn't know he was immortal because he had memory loss. So could Conrad be thousands of years old and maybe not even remember it, but he's just been around? I mean, he's like a disfigured, tough old bird who just keeps on going, which again sounds like a lot of later Zelazny characters, Jack of Shadows and Sam and what have you. So could he have been around for thousands of years? I think it's possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't show that he has, but there's just ambiguity enough. And there's a proprietary nature to the way he goes about defending Earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody wants him to take direct action. Like, no, you got to kill this Vagan. This Vagan must die. That's the way to save it. But he plays the long game.
Mm-hmm.
He basically makes the Earth unpalatable to be taken over by the Vagans. I mean, the deconstruction of the pyramids is brilliant.
Yes.
It's like, that's genius. Of course, if you take down all the monuments, what will the Vagans want? Nothing.
Right, right. Yeah, I like when, Mishtigo, the Vagan, says, they're desecrating a monument to the past glories of the human race. And Conrad says, nothing is cheaper than past glories.
Nothing is cheaper than past glories. Yeah, that definitely a line to think of. Now I'm going to go into side note, because one of my interests is role-playing games. Do you play role-playing games? Seth?
I don't. It's never appealed to me. So
okay. So I'm going to tell you about Traveler. Traveler is one of the early, core role-playing games. I mean, everyone talks about Dungeons & Dragons and all that, but Traveler was the first real science fiction role-playing game.
Okay.
And it's set in a far future galactic empire, tens of thousands of years in the future. But in the history, we find that way in our past, aliens basically took lots of humans and dropped them on a whole bunch of different worlds. 100,000 years ago. And some of those humans developed technology and went to the stars much faster than we did, including the Volani Empire, which is tens of thousands of years old. So when the humans, when we go out into space and we run into more humans, we run into this empire that's thousands of years old, and they come to Earth as like, and they see the pyramids, because the pyramids are like 5,000 years old. They think the pyramids are nothing because they have records going back almost 10 times that. So the pyramids feel drab and small by comparison to the mighty but decaying Volani Empire, which then subsequently gets knocked over by Sol. It's like the whole barbarians at the gate sort of thing, and then that collapses, and then thousands of years later, a new galactic empire arises. But kind of like I'm diving into all sorts of authors there. Kind of like Asimov's Far Future, where. Is Earth the home of humanity? No one's quite sure.
Right. In the Traveler universe, myth at this point.
Right. In the Traveler universe, no one's quite sure that Earth is the original. There's competing theories that, oh, man just arose on a bunch of worlds and all this stuff. Now, the humans that live in and around Earth say, oh, yes, Earth is the center. Earth is the original. But they're dismissed by the rest of the Galactic Empire as just cranks and idiots. The Soleimani first, basically only man, those idiots are just off on the corner. Ignore them. We have a galactic empire. Earth is unimportant.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So I keep thinking about that sort of thing when coming back to here and having this old ruined Earth and Conrad taking the Vagan around and basically ruining it more by deconstructing things to make it even less. I mean, the planet's full of hot zones. It's not a great planet. That also ties in with the Asimov future history, where Earth is lots of radioactive spots on that Earth as well.
Right.
I mean, as I recall, only like the area around Mount Everest is really habitable in Asimov's world. This here, it's a little better, but we get those hot zones and things coming out of those hot zones. So his long range goal. I mean, he only gets a sense that in the prior thing, as a more mainline rebel, he took more direct action and that didn't work. So now he's playing a longer rope-a-dope game to basically make poison the well so that the Vagans won't want it. And that works. And he becomes basically the ruler of Earth he's basically given the deed and the keys at the end. It's like, congratulations, you now own a planet.
I mean, if you take the idea that he is Pan in some way, then it's like that was already his role, and they're just making it official, official again.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting thing in this is, you know, I understand radioactive half-lives and everything. That kind of gives you an idea for how long it's been. If there's still hot zones, you know, it's not unimaginably far in the future. But, you know, there are some kinds of bombs that it would be thousands of years before their radiation would decay to a
tolerable level. Yeah.
But I don't really have any idea how long it's been since the 3 days. And before that, who knows how much history there was before then. But when I look at stuff like, you know, for me, clues about like the boa dial, right? Where it's like, it's a mutant mix of a constricting snake and a crocodile. That's evidently like a giant millipede or something. You know, that's not the kind of thing that just pops up overnight. It takes time for that kind of mutation to develop.
Well, if you're writing from a strict, now remember he's writing in the 60s, so
that's true.
Before yeah. a lot of modern genetics was put down. I mean, that's kind of like almost got like a 50s pulp sort of thing. Like mutants coming out of the bottom is a very 50s trope that he's basically playing with here. Not only the boa dial, but the vampire, the quote unquote vampire that we get the fight with the cannibalistic mutant tribe is basically a mutant as well, and we get the sense that he's playing with those atomic age horror tropes to come up with strange creatures out of myth and legend to plague the world from the wild places. I mean, going back to the panel, like the wild places here are hot and dangerous, and that's where the monsters come out of. And that's a very much like the monsters coming out of the dark is a very mythic trope that he uses again and again throughout his work.
Mm-hmm.
So he's laying it down here and uses it elsewhere. But Conrad being Pan as Pan is kind of like of that and against that at the same time. He's not the full right defender of civilization, but on the other hand, he's not allowing civilization to be overrun by these things either.
Yeah.
I mean, so
for the first, I don't know, for the first 100 pages of the book, I was wondering, you know, what exactly is going to happen here? Is there going to be a consistent through line? And it's just sort of more like going from place to place and things happen and they move on with the questions going back and forth between the various members of the party about, are we going to kill this guy or are we not going to? And Conrad finding himself in the place of, no, I'm going to protect him, even though I know that this other member of the party, Hassan,
the assassin,
person.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. But Conrad is pretty confident in his abilities, and Hassan is aware of his abilities as well. And at some point, he tests him by sending his golem, which is like a sparring robot or something, after Conrad. And I thought that was an amusing scene. And there's a great quote in here. And this is one thing I wanted to say was Zelazny writes beautifully.
I love his language. But both the poetic and then just like the sharp thing. I have only one serious question then about your fondness for destruction, he stated. What is that? Is it really art? Go to hell.
Right.
It's like, bah! So he has this nice poetic descriptions and things, and then suddenly like, yep, sharp as attack dialogue.
Yeah.
But you were going to quote something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I like, so he finishes the fight with the golem, finally defeats it. And it says, I took 7 steps and then someone must have pulled out the plug because I gurgled, everything swirled and the world ran away down the drain. And I thought that's beautiful.
And it's just like the slow revelations of things. Like, I mean, especially after the fact, like Hassan revealing that he had poisoned the vampire and was just trying to play rope-a-dope with him to get him, get let the poison go through. I mean, we get not Cassandra, the other woman, intervene in the fight, and that causes more problems. Not that I expected them to actually abide by the terms of the fight with the vampire at all. I mean, I think it's clear that it's a rigged game, no matter what. But
yeah, and you know, I felt really bad for the dead man, right? That's what he's called, and described using the term mongoloid, which is not.
There's some unfortunate choices in that sort of verbiage. And in general, if we're talking about lowlights of the book at this point, except for Cassandra, the women characters don't come off well. I mean, but again, unfortunately, much as I love Arthur Zelazny, that's kind of a weakness of a lot of his work, that he doesn't do women characters all that well. Mm-hmm. I mean, thinking to Amber, and thinking about the Succession, and the princesses are just like shunted off, like being unfit. Like the daughters of this mythic king, you don't think they have power power and ability. You're just going to shunt them off to the side, and oh yeah, the men will decide who will win. Again, role playing. One of the role playing games I've played for a long while, no surprise, is the Ember Diceless role-playing game, which is set in that universe. And most of the campaigns and games I've played in that universe very, very directly work against that to make the women characters much more the potent forces that they must most clearly be, that Roger Zelazny himself couldn't see that they are.
Yeah.
Because of his upbringing and nature, that he missed the trick. So, yeah, so there's some unfortunate word choices, and women characters in this book don't come off that great. I mean, Cassandra disappears in a storm and does come back, and does speak some prophecy. But again, the main characters to focus on are basically the Vagan, Conrad, and Hassan, really, as a trio of competing forces. Yeah. I mean, other people is a more diffuse sort of sense. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's 8 or 9 characters that are mentioned consistently, but I didn't really have a good sense of any of them except for Conrad, Hassan, and the Vagan.
I mean Moresby, the guy that's running Candlestick Tribe, yeah. We kind of get his deal too as an adversary. But yeah, so I mean, Zelazny's more interested in other things, unfortunately, and so some characters. So readers who want deep character dives into all the characters in the book are going to, even in a short book like this, going to be disappointed in the blanks that we get.
Sure, sure. But it's, you know, I do enjoy the interactions between, this is where the title comes from, because Hassan keeps calling him Karagi, something like that.
Right, and Karagi, which is kind of a distortion of one of his previous names.
Right.
Because Hassan's got a sense of who he really is.
Yeah, so then Conrad keeps, you know, ending his discussions with him, and call me Conrad. And that's where we get the title.
Which, again, is a distortion of his original Greek roots. So, but again, having different names, again, is something Zelazny would do time and again. Muhammad Samatsan, or just call me Sam, or Corwin's got a bunch of aliases throughout Shadow and so on and so forth. It's something he likes to play with. Like, does someone's identity and nature change if you rename them, if they rename themselves? Names have power. How much power do names have?
Yeah.
And it's something that Zelazny likes to play with a lot.
Well, and he seemed to have a fascination with the idea of long life and, you know, forms of immortality.
Yes. And kind of like Larry Niven's early stories, especially, have long life characters and the implications of that. Zelazny likes to go a little more mythic than the more straight line science fiction of Niven. It's like, what do long characters mean, and how do they influence the basically mythic landscape around them, becoming basically figures of legend? Even if they don't want to, or even they don't admit it, they influence things. I mean, Conrad in his early iteration influenced an entire generation of people reacting against the Vagans.
Right.
Even if he's not admitting directly that, yeah, he was that same person, although his companions try to tease that out, it's like he's kind of making a stamp upon the world in various iterations as he takes on various guys. I mean, you could think of, because they mentioned his previous iteration falls into the ocean and comes out again. You can almost think of that. I can think of in mythic terms as like a rebirth coming out of the sea.
Yeah.
Kind of like becoming the new person, Conrad. Mm-hmm. But that old person and what they've done is still out there, because, you know, witness Bortan the dog. It's like,
right. There's kind of a series of ex machinas, you know, where at some point you get the Chekhov's gun of talking about the dog and how the dog has been missing, but someone says, no, I've seen it. And then Conrad, I think, hears the dog from a long way off. And then right at the crucial moment when they're about to be roasted, well, I think he's about to be disemboweled, right?
Yep.
And then preserved using radioactive pits or something for future consumption. And that's when, is it Bortan? Borlan?
Bortan, yeah.
Yeah, Bortan comes in triumphantly and helps him out.
Or like his duel with Hassan, because he's going to get ready to duel with Hassan, and then he's ready to do that, ready to do the death blow on him, because he got the rock that says that carries death, and then Moresby's guys show up and he does kill one of them, but yeah, he's prevented from killing Hassan because of that timely negative ex machina of the arrival of the new enemy to interrupt the deadly duel. So yeah, so
and then Cassandra at the very end, right?
And then Cassandra at the very end. So it's like, yeah, it's like it is. I mean, I don't read this novel for the plot so much as the Billingdon's roman, the sort of basically the jumping from place to place and seeing these places and these characters in those milieus.
Picaresque kind of thing.
Picaresque, thank you. Yeah. The picaresque. Nature of the picaresque mythic nature of the story is what draws me back to this and why I enjoyed it so much. I mean, it's not of people who want a strong narrative plot with all the answers all lined up and needed. Like, what happens next? What is kind of going to rebuild the earth? How is he going to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of decided that people aren't going to return from Earth. Return to Earth from their emigration, but so what is he going to do? What about the hot zones? What about all those? What are the people like Moresby and the other creatures out there? What is to be done? And that's left all vague. I'm fine with that because there's all sorts of ways this could go, especially if he is as mythic and long lived as he seems to be. But
yeah,
it's just left. And it's left for the reader to imagine rather than having a knight's bow tied up to it.
Yeah. Well, at some point he's interacting with the satyrs and you know, playing a sad song on the panpipes with them. And it seems like that's his low point where he's just saying, look, this is over. You know, the earth is gone. And then I think through the kind of events of the book, he finds out that the Vegans don't want to destroy it or anything or really take it over. And they're actually going to hand over the keys to him. And so maybe it'll be okay.
It's like a dark night of the soul for Conrad.
Yeah.
Like this second life has not gone great and he's got to work his way through it and then comes out on the other side with the promise of a new dawn and a new life. I mean, Cassandra saved after all and he can go about his new business and his new role and with some hope and optimism, which he didn't have through that low point. I mean, he thought he was going to get killed or kill Hassan and that would have been terrible.
Yeah. I don't want to underrate how funny this book is because it really is quite humorous and in places, but it's also sort of sad in places. But I liked when they're in Athens and essentially they come to a house that's like been turned into a museum to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it says things like, Constantine Karagiosis sat in this chair and he says, I was really afraid to go into the bathroom.
Yes. I mean, he has a wry sense of humor about his role and tries to, and especially when people, I mean, it's like lots of wordplay in his fencing, especially when people are trying to nail him down as who he was. Like, depends on the name. So try Karagiosis. Try sitting that way where I can see you. I don't like to have people standing behind me. Yeah. All right, there. So what? So try Karagiosis. Why should I? Because it means something. At least it did once.
Mm-hmm.
Karagiosis was a figure in the old Greek shadow shows, sort of like a punch in the European Punch and Judy plays. He was a slob and a buffoon. He's basically knocking down himself a peg.
Yeah.
He was also a half hero, cunning, somewhat gross, sense of humor. He'd tear down a pyramid. Also, he was strong when he wanted to be.
Yeah.
So yeah, so it mixes lots of wry humor, lots of wordplay, lots of fun stuff.
Well, and there's lots of little hints at the larger world too, right? Where at some point Stigo is describing Talar, which is the Vegan world, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and telling, I can't remember if it was Diane or if it was one of the other woman characters, was saying that I can't really describe it to you because you wouldn't see it the way I do, because we, our visual range is different. Right? They don't see, I think he said they don't see red, but they see more, they have several colors that...
They have colors beyond blue and violet.
Into the ultraviolet. And he said, like, you know, you see my arms as blue, but I see a pattern. And anyone seeing that pattern would know what family I belong to. And I thought that was really cool, just alien science fiction stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's tiny little detail, just imagining, yeah, there are more colors than what we match. I mean, even in human history, I was discussing this with a friend the other day, until the 17th century, we didn't have a name for the color orange.
Right.
I mean, yeah, there was a spectrum there, but people called it red or yellow, or the Greeks. I mean, Conrad, we should clear out, is clearly from Greece, and a lot of novels takes in Greece. Way back when, 2,500 years ago, Homer described the wine dark sea, not the blue sea, not
right.
The wine dark sea, because there wasn't a word for the color blue in ancient Greek.
Yeah, even in Japan, I was learning some Japan just for some Japanese for work, and the teacher said that a certain generation the older generation in Japan won't distinguish between green and blue. It's all just ao, which is their word for blue, and there is the word for green, midori, but it's more like younger people will use that word, but older people would just say it's all blue.
So yeah, so even beyond having the better visual spectrum, the way people can see the world changes, and you kind of see that in Conrad's story. I mean, his early Karagosa saw the world and the conflict very differently than Conrad does. It's the same person, but he's kind of had to change. He's had to come out of the sea and have that rebirth to see things differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, he nearly dies, but he finally buys a vowel, but he has to go through that experience in order to come out again and become a new iteration of this immortal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like there's previous history and maybe future books where it's like the further adventures of Conrad and Hassan, because they have such a natural.
They have a long connection. History and a natural rapport and a rivalry going against each other that is delightful. I mean, we also get that with Conrad and the Vegan with the letters and whatnot, but Hassan and Conrad clearly have stories that extend backwards and forwards that are only hinted at here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very sweet moment where Conrad is grieving because he believes that Cassandra has been killed. And Hassan comes over and comforts him and says, like, you know, what has happened. It's tragic. It is what is written, but let it also be put down that I grieve with you. I thought that was very, very sweet.
It was a moment of pathos and touching and connection between the two men that I really, really do appreciate as well.
Yep. And then there's the whole part where, you know, Hassan Conrad tries to pin down Hassan and say, look, just tell me if you were sent to kill the Vegan. Just tell me straight out so that we can have a fight. And he's trying to make the challenge happen in a way that has the most advantage to himself. And Hassan's doing the same, right? Because if Conrad issues the challenge, then Hassan gets to choose what the fight will be.
Right. And he doesn't want to choose something that Hassan's going to have an advantage over him on.
Yeah. And so then I thought it was interesting, the sling and the stone, you know, David's sling, right? And then subsequent to that, you have them fighting essentially this giant.
Yeah. He's not being subtle there at all.
No, I don't think so. I'm looking through my notes to see if there's anything else I wrote down.
I did have another thought.
Uh-huh.
Because now we were talking earlier about books that this resonates with. And now I came up with, as we were talking and discussing, I came up with another one.
Okay.
Sadzi Hussein's The Gurkha and the Lord of Tuesday is a world very much feels like could be this, except thousands of miles to the east around Kathmandu, because that's again a far future. Earth has fallen. There's all sorts of the outside between cities is not safe, but inside cities you have AIs but on the other hand, that also sounds science fictiony and normal. But on the other hand, the main character basically the Lord Tuesday is basically a deity that the that gets woken up from under his mountain and goes to the city to basically confront this AI. So that feels like readers who like this would definitely like that. And there's a sequel coming, especially when I was thinking about this. There's a sequel coming this year. When is it coming? It's out already. Correction. I haven't read it yet. Called Kondo Wakes Up, which is set in that same world, but down in Chittagong instead. But it's again, people who like this sort of stuff will like Saad B. Hussein and vice versa, I think.
Okay. I'm
writing
that
making
down.
Connections. I do like making connections with books. It's one of the things I like to do. We just had to tease that, like, oh yeah, that's right. And I had to stop and think, like, what was the name of that book again? Yes, The Gurkha and the Lord of Tuesday.
Nice.
So there's lots of stuff that I don't know if you'd have to have read this book. There's lots of stuff this book can resonate with, especially on the mythic side of things, where we mix a myth and legend and that sort of feel into your science fiction and fantasy. That's where Zelazny's influence really pours into. Not so much this book, but other Zelazny, maybe not, kind of runs into Max Gladstone's work. I'm thinking particularly of Last Exit, which just came out a couple months ago as of the time of this recording. So, but that's much more Amber focused. But again, that's sort of myths and making myths and reflecting out onto what you are out onto the world. And again, now thinking through this as I'm thinking about it, that book is about characters who did a thing some time ago and now are coming back to deal with the consequences of that thing, kind of like Conrad in his early iteration. Such as this whole conflict with the Vegans and then the return, and now in this new iteration is working through the implications of that and who he was and who they were, who he was then versus who he was now, and who they were, who the characters in the first novel, in the backstory of the novel, versus who they are in the present, kind of resonating with each other and influencing each other.
Yeah. What did you think about that? You know, you sort of find at the very end of the book a bit of an exposition dump in a letter about you know, here's why I didn't want the alien killed. And I can't remember the character. Was that Phil?
Yes.
Yeah, because one of the characters dies, right? One is injured in the fight with the Carites.
Yeah, Phil dies in the escape.
Right.
We get some info dumping about what's really going on. It feels a little lumpy, to be honest.
It does.
We also get the letter from Mishtigo, which also feels lumpy as well.
A little bit. Though I did like that it ended with him saying, go to hell.
Yes, it's a nice reference backwards. Go to hell yourself. Yes. But I commend the earth into the hands of the Kalanick Nazaros. According to legend, this would be a grave mistake. However, I'm willing to gamble that even a character Nazaros under false pretenses, you destroy only what you mean to rebuild. That's a really powerful sentence, really true. It does feel like, okay, I'm going to have to wrap this up and explain enough that people will be satisfied. And
yeah,
there's just no good way to leaven that into the story. So here we have, get it. But I mean, it has even a happy ending. So it's like he's by the seashore with the love of his life. And
right.
There's that little undigested bump at the end to try to get us to that happy ending.
It reminded me for all the world of at least in the early Foundation books, right, where a thing would happen and then the Selden Vault would open up and he'd come out and say, hey, here's the thing that just happened, explaining why it was supposed to work that way.
Yeah, that's pretty fair. Like, yep, here it, and especially in the Foundation books when the mule shows up and that's all upended, like, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah, no, that is not at all what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when the straight track that you've set goes completely sideways, like, okay, now what do we do?
Yeah. But I think, you know, if he had tried to sprinkle in some of what we learned there to the rest of the book, it wouldn't have worked tonally. We couldn't have gotten him to those places. He wouldn't have had the questions that he had.
Yeah. So to keep the picaresque mythic adventure, you had to keep the mystery and that unexplained stuff to the end. But in the end, it's kind of like putting, it's like putting off the bill, but at the end, you got to finally pay that check or leave the reader unsatisfied. So it's kind of, unfortunate. It's kind of like a great meal, and then suddenly you're presented with the check and you got to stop and give your credit card, which kind of ends the meal on a weird note, different than spending a couple hours eating and enjoying with these people. But
yeah,
but you know, but you can't have the meal without it.
Yeah, I didn't hate it, but it's I don't know. It is what it is.
But I mean, it's not. I mean, it's something he learned better later on. He doesn't quite go for that undigested. I mean, it's much more smoother in later novels and stories that he doesn't have that undigested lump of like, oh, here's what you missed.
Yeah, yeah. I do like that description of it though. A lump.
A lump.
Anything else you want to talk about this book?
We talked about the gorgeous writing. We talked about the characters. This novel made me want to go. I've never been to Greece or Egypt. I've been to Rome in Italy, but I would like to, I mean, COVID and politics and the state of the world keep me from, especially from Egypt. I would like to see Egypt, but and also some Greece. I would like to see the roots of classical civilization at some point, if the world will let me. So in this book helped like spark that, like the pyramids and Athens and the wild places of Arcadia, Mount Olympus, and all the rest. I would like, so this novel reignited my wanderlust, which isn't, I'm fond of the novel because it's making me want to do things I want to do. So it was pleasant to see this vision of a future Earth and spend time with these characters and wonder, well, I'd like to go tromping around those places too. Thank you, Zelazny. And it was good to read my first Zelazny in a couple of years. So it was good to get back into the Zelazny groove, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed this one, and it's, I think Lord of Light is a better book. This one goes down.
He's got several years of extra writing under his belt. And that is, as a stone cold, probably if you wanted to do something as crazy and insane as try to rank all the Hugo winners. We're a couple months past. If you want to do March Madness and try to rank the Hugo winners against each other, the Lord of Light would probably get a very high seed and go very deep into the tournament.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's an idea. I have to think about that.
Yeah.
There's an idea. I have to see if a bracketology for Hugo winners.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'd participate in that. I mean, I have a sort of a running ranking going on, but I'm not really trying to tease out what the best book is. I'm just ranking it on my own enjoyment.
Yeah, I mean, but best, I think best is very, very, very dicey proposition for any book. I mean, even the Hugo's best novel, it's really favorite.
Yes.
And favorite as picked by the electorate, and even for a jury, more even for the smaller award, like the relatively smaller, like the Nebula, as far as the voting population, or any of the juried awards, like Crawford or what have you, it's really favorite is really the word that nobody wants to use, but it really is the case where people are voting their favorite. People generally, at least me, maybe I'm wrong. I vote my favorite more than I'll vote a book I like more than a book that I think, oh yeah, this is technically good, but I really like this book. That's the book I'm voting for. I'm not going to vote against my likes just because I think a book is technically more proficient.
Right. Yeah.
But I know other people do it differently. Your mileage may vary, as always.
As always. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to reading more Zelazny because, you know, I've talked
about it. How much have you read besides this and Lord of Light?
Just Lord of Light, this, and Damnation Alley.
Well, that's an interesting one to read. And you've seen the movie?
I have. Yeah, we did it for Take Me to
It's
the Reader.
It's very different.
Oh, it's very different. Yeah.
It's very, very different. I mean, I watched the movie, being child of the 80s, and then when I finally read the book, it's like, what the? This is not the movie at all. It was kind of like, oh, it was a real experience with, Hollywood adaptations versus the actual texts.
Yep. In that episode of Take Me to Your Reader, I think we fixed this thing. Like, we figured out how do you make a better movie out of that with some of the changes that they made, but still make it work.
It can be done.
It can be done.
The thing I remember most about the movie is the killer cockroaches in Las Vegas. Yep. That's what sticks in my mind.
Oh, the scorpions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I have Nine Princesses and Amber. I've just never read them. I've never read
Nine Princesses of Amber nicely stands alone enough that you can read that and not read the rest. I mean, I'm a partisan. I think you like all the rest. The first five. I mean, to be perfectly blunt, the Merlin series, which is the second five, isn't as good as the first by any stretch of the imagination. They don't hold the candle. They do interesting things, but Merlin is not his dad. As a character, sad to say. I mean, it does correct some of the flaws of the first series, especially when it comes to women characters. I mean, the women characters in the second series are better and stronger than they did learn, but the power, especially of the writing of the first series does not transfer into the second ones at all. So
yeah.
Give Nine Princes of Amber a try. It's short. And see if it's your bag. I mean, for some people it's not their bag. It's definitely my bag. Mm-hmm. That turned me on to a whole slew of multiverse fiction. And that's kind of one of my eternal jams, multiverse fiction, myth and legend and stuff. And this novel brought me back to the myth and legend, and old characters have weird histories that they themselves may not want to admit or can say that is overshadowing their present acts. Like, well, for Nine Princes of Amber, that really hits in the second novel, The Guns of Avalon, where Corwin's past in a different shadow kind of catches up with them in a way.
So I'm looking forward to that one. It's near the top of my list. I've been making a list of like what I want to read when I finish with all the Hugo winners, and it's right up there. So I'll definitely do that.
I mean, I think it was a Hugo nominee for 70, I think.
Okay. Nice.
So it didn't win, but no. I don't think it actually was a Hugo nominee. No. It was off the ballot entirely, which is weird. Mm. No, I'd have to look at Joe Walton's lists of Hugo. I mean, you know about her series at tour.com, right?
So
I wonder what she said about Damnation. About this book. I didn't look because I didn't want to.
She didn't say a whole lot. Thoughts. She didn't do any spoiler discussion. I was reading it earlier.
Yeah, I didn't want to influence my thoughts, infect them with hers, because she has a prodigious set of opinions of her own, and I didn't want to mix her opinions into mine. It's like, you know, entangle what she was thinking with what I was thinking. I like to express my own thoughts without accidentally or intentionally stealing other people's or mixing mine with theirs without proper attribution. I mean, I will say like, oh yes, X said Y, but I didn't want to, I wanted to give you a clean Paul take on the book.
Nice. Well, that's what I wanted. So thank you.
That's what you wanted. Exactly. Yeah. You didn't want Paul reads the book and then Paul reads Joe Walton and other authors and distills that.
Right.
There's a time and place for that, but that's not here. Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like we're about wrapped on the book. So I do want to thank you for choosing this one, for picking up one of the earlier titles that was still left on there. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. This is a golden opportunity to revisit a book and an excuse to read something older and revisit the first of his Lazzi novels, as it so happens. So this was a golden opportunity. It was a pleasure to be on your podcast to talk about it.
Well, so before we sign off, I know you mentioned your social media stuff earlier, but why don't you go ahead and reiterate it? Where can people find you?
You can find me on all social media generally as Prince Justin. That's PrinceJBSTIN. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Discord. I'm on Instagram. I have a website, www.princejustin.com. I have a Patreon, patreon.com/PrinceJustin. You'll find me at tour.com, at Nerds of a Feather, at Skiffy and Fanty, at SSF Audio. You'll find me in lots and lots of places. You just Google Prince Justin and you'll run into something I've said, written, or done, and you can follow the breadcrumbs to what I'm up to.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you. Great meeting you. I'm sure that, you know, at a future con, I'll look for you.
Absolutely. It'd be a pleasure to meet you in person, Seth.
All right. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Paul. I thought he was really great. Make sure to check out his social media links and website links. I'll put all those in the show notes. It's a pretty extensive link of comps for this book. really interesting one to read. Let me know what you think of the book as well. As always, I invite you to share the episode on social media. If you want to get a hold of me, you can at Hugo's Podcast. You can send an email to feedback@hugospodcast.com or go up to the website and send me contact form. Like I mentioned, I only have like 3 titles that are left unclaimed for the podcast. And I'm looking at about this time next year, maybe this year plus a month or two, to wrap up the main project for this podcast, catching up with all the Hugo winners. So that's kind of exciting. But I do need to book those last 3 episodes. So if you would like to support what I'm doing here and my other podcasting, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and sign up to support there. I have been doing some exclusive content there, which is, it's nice when I get the time to do it. And make sure you vote in the Hugo Awards. Hugo Girl is nominated and Paul is also nominated. So I think that'll do it for this time. I'm going to go walk my dogs. So thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.